Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to be talking about a set of issues, interrelated and very, very important, with a man who I'm proud to call both a friend as well as a very esteemed colleague. A man who has devoted his entire life to protecting our country, especially against foreign adversaries like the Chinese Communist Party, a topic on which he has been more insightful and more courageous than practically anybody else I can think of, notably in his role as a senior naval intelligence officer, including serving as the chief of intelligence for the U.S. Pacific Fleet. His last duty station at the end of a very distinguished career in the uniform of the United States Navy. His name is Captain James Fennell. He's certainly no stranger to this program or to the work we do with him at the Committee on the Present Danger, China, and the webinar series to which he has contributed frequently and with great effect. Jim is these days with the Geneva Center for Security Policy, not to be confused with the real one, as I'm fond of saying, here in Washington, D.C., ours. But he is contributing very, very mightily, notably these days in partnership with our mutual friend and colleague, Brad Thayer, in a series of columns that they're producing jointly at American Greatness. And I strongly commend them to all of you. Captain Fennell, welcome aboard, sir. It's great to have you with us, as always. And I know you've been under the weather a little bit, so we're especially appreciative of your mustering out to give us a hand.
Well, thanks, Frank. Good to be back with you.
Thank you. Jim, I want to talk about something that is being treated as though it's some kind of messy, you know, political nonsense in Washington, D.C. I think it's anything but. A senator by the name of Tommy Tuberville of Alabama has put a hold now on some 300 nominations to individuals who are either in senior positions at the moment or are being promoted into them, all of whom are before the United States Senate for its approval for those adjustments in their current posts and ranks in many cases. Senator Tuberville was initially motivated by his strong objection to what the Pentagon was doing illegally, in his view and mine, to use federal funds in abortion-related activity, travel and other expenses, in violation of federal law. And over time, he's been trying to persuade the Pentagon to abandon that illegal behavior. He's become more and more attuned and I think cognizant of the need to address what I think of as the cultural Marxist assault on our military that is actually being evidenced in the public positions of, by some estimates, 42% of the military officers, men and women, many of them general officers at the moment, in the question of whether or not we can continue to promote this kind of agenda of diversity, equity, inclusion, and critical race theory, and transgender accommodations, and the whole social engineering. You've lived and breathed Navy, worn the uniform, served the country with great distinction. I'd ask you if you have thoughts on this topic, and in particular, the nature of the challenge that we are now facing from this so-called woke agenda inside the ranks.
Well, Frank, it's a very hot topic, as you described, and I know many of, I retired in 2015, and a lot of my peers from that same time period, some, you know, say that it's not an issue, but to me, it seems that it's very clearly an issue when you have, for instance, Senator Tuberville, who's taken a stand and said, I do not believe I should be approving the promotions of flag and general officers until the department gives up this illegal practice of supporting abortions. And he said that, "I do not think my holding up of the promotions will have an adverse impact on the military." The other side says, "Yes, it is." Well, if they're true to their word, and given the low numbers of abortions that have occurred overall in the military, why would they not just say, "Okay, we're going to set this aside because our readiness, combat readiness, is the most important thing"? Yet they won't do it. For them, it's not about combat readiness. It is about achievement of the social reengineering of the U.S. military. When I retired in 2015, everything was 100% about the mission. And the mission included taking care of our people, but it wasn't about forcing things that you just described, DEI and CRT and woke agenda and transgenderism, down the throats of a military. And I would add in vaccines as well. So you had a lot of things that were just forced onto the workforce, the military force, and it just seemed to have no bearing whatsoever with combat lethality, while concurrently we were watching our combat capabilities and readiness decline rapidly, not only in the Ukraine as our stocks of ammunition gets depleted, but from my perspective, where I spent my career focusing on the Pacific, how we did not respond for the last 25 years as the Chinese Navy and other parts of their military grew beyond all recognition, while ours continued to decline, especially under the Obama administration. So for me, people say things in Washington, D.C., but it's almost always about politics. And so I like to talk to people that worked out in the fleet, out in the field, and that's where we should be taking our recommendations on what needs to be done.
Well, and some, to be fair, are saying, those in the field, if you will, or in the fleet, are saying, you know, this is having a terrible impact on the families of these men and women who are being promoted, that it's, you know, preventing them from moving as they expected to and getting out of housing or, you know, getting into housing for that matter. And Jim, I guess, you know, where this comes to the rubber meeting the road, as far as I'm concerned, is I get there's a hardship there. And we impose upon those families and their loved ones a lot.
I'm sorry, Frank. Let me interject here. I'm sorry. I am not sympathetic to those complaints. We're talking about flag and general officers, people that make hundreds of thousands of dollars. I served for 29 years. I moved 13 or 14 times in 29 years. If someone had told my wife, "Hey, you have to stay in Hawaii or Japan or Washington, D.C. for an extra year and not uproot again," she would have thanked them. So this idea that they're under a hardship is a load of baloney.
Yeah. Well, I take that point, Jim, and I would defer to your most intimate knowledge of it. But I just wanted to make the larger point, which it seems to me is, if that's considered to be impairing national security, what does one say about the things that you mentioned a moment ago? That the readiness of our force is in extremis at the moment. And we can't recruit people to serve. We're not training the people who are serving properly because we're feeding them all of this nonsense during their training time. I mean, those things have to be a more important consideration, it seems to me, if you actually are concerned about the national security, no?
Or what about the hardship of our petty officers and junior enlisted personnel that are on food stamps, that don't have enough time or money to take care of their own families, that have to commute to get to their workstations and don't have the proper because the dollar's declining. So I don't want to hear from flag and general officers or senior executive service people telling me how hard they have it. It's a load. It's also, as we've been discussing, it doesn't even touch on the readiness of the operational requirements we have.
We're going to touch on that on the other side of a very short break. We'll be right back with more with Captain James Fennell, United States Navy, retired, a great American and a patriot of the First Order. We'll be right back. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Speaker Kevin McCarthy's announcement yesterday that the House will launch a formal impeachment inquiry of Joe Biden surely starts the countdown to the president's early departure from office. Of course, the Senate seems unlikely to convict when, not if, the House impeaches this chief executive for bribery, other high crimes and misdemeanors, and deservedly for treason. Rather, he'll have to go because even his own partisans will conclude that his position is untenable and they stand to suffer politically if he remains in office. No patriotic American can relish the prospect that, at least for a time, Kamala Harris might, like her running mate, become president in name only. But she, too, will have to go, lest she precipitate a GOP electoral landslide too big to steal. Fraught history is being made. And we must pray the Republic survives it. This is Frank Affney. We're back, and we're continuing our conversation with one of the men I admire most in our country. Well, in the world, as it happens, he's deployed overseas most of the time. His name is Captain James Fennell. He's a retired naval intelligence officer and has been at the forefront, really, of raising the alarm for, well, now decades about what we will face from the Chinese Communist Party. And it's that context, Jim. You've called it a decade of concern, which we are now very much in. I would argue we're actually in a window of acute vulnerability in that decade, arising from the evident preparations and expressed interest of Xi Jinping in going to war, not just with Taiwan, but with us as well. I want to talk to you about that prospect in a moment. But before we get there, there are several people who are intimately involved in this whole matter of the readiness of our forces and the modernization of their equipment and the other kinds of, factors that bear on the deterrence of most especially the Chinese Communist Party. People I'm thinking like C.Q. Brown, currently the chief of staff of the United States Air Force, has been for 3 years. We've seen the strength of his service, according to the Heritage Foundation, going from marginal to very weak in the course of the time he's been in. We've had even the Secretary of the Air Force expressing strong concern about how prepared his service is for war with China, and rightly so. We've had Lisa Franchetti, the current Vice Chief of Naval Operations of your beloved Naval Service, who's now been tapped to become the next CNO. And the question is whether, you know, she's the best person for this job or whether she's being promoted, as I think probably C.Q. Brown is, for considerations of their sex or their gender, their race or what have you. Talk to me about the real dangers associated with making promotions on those bases, as opposed to on the sheer merits of performance, especially in combat.
Frank, a bit of a sea story. When I was a lieutenant commander on board the USS Kitty Hawk with Air Wing 11, someone had written in from the fleet an article saying that we needed to promote the commanders of the air wings based upon a quota system that didn't exclusively go to people that had strike warfare experience that were in FN-18 squadrons particularly. And they said we should have an equitable distribution amongst Hornet pilots, Tomcat pilots, A6 or EA-6B, Hilo pilots, and VAW E-2 pilots. And the first article—
That was a long time ago, Jim. That was not even the earlier Obama-Biden team, as I recall.
When that article hit proceedings, the first letter to the editor I ever wrote as an officer was regarding this article and the suggestion that we should have quotas for combat leadership. And I disagreed then, and I still now, this many years later, 26, 27 years later, I still disagree. And there's no excuse for promoting people based on anything other than their operational leadership experience, the sustained superior performance at sea. And so when I see these nominations in this administration from across, not just in the Department of Defense, but across all the departments, it's very clear that we're seeing nominations for government positions that are based upon things that are based on gender, race, and other things that have nothing to do with whether or not the person is the most qualified. Now, I know Lisa Franchetti and I serve with her. She's a nice person, but her operational record compared to somebody like Admiral Paprow, who's still the commander of the Pacific Fleet, are vastly different. They're both in the same year group. They both had been nominated independently, first Paprow to be the CNO by the Secretary of Defense, and then that changed. So it's not that she's a bad person. She's a VCNO. But as Brad Thayer and I wrote in an article for American Greatness earlier this year, one of the problems we have is we haven't had a revolt of the admirals like we had in the 1940s, where we had admirals that were willing to say, this is not acceptable, that we're not building our Navy up. And so when I see someone like Lisa Franchetti, she's somebody that's gone along to go along or went along to go along. She is the VCNO. So you have to ask yourself in the years that she's been the Vice Chief of Naval Operations, what has she done to stand up and say, this is unacceptable? Our shipbuilding program is so pathetic. When she's been in other positions like the Joint Staff J5, did she give speeches talking about the threat from China? I don't see those. I haven't seen those. Whereas Admiral Paprow is somebody that has been very vocal about speaking out about China and vocal about saying we need more. So we need people today that are going to be disruptive to the go along to get along situation, because as we just discussed, we are now fully into the decade of concern. And as many, many people from across the national security spectrum are saying, we could see war in 12 to 18 months with Taiwan. And so,
Taiwan and quite possibly with us as well. I mean, this correct. Is the overarching problem is that they may decide that they're going to try to acquire Taiwan through force, but they also understand they ought to do something about the possibility, at least, that we might interfere with that. And there's a lot of evidence that they're preparing to preclude us from being able to do that. And Jim, again, I just want to salute you for your clarity on this problem set and the fact that it is greatly intensifying by the day. I think I'm right in saying that you were one of those who pointed out that in the foreseeable future, if not at the present, certainly soon, the growth of the Chinese naval forces compared to what is our continued decline of our own, especially since only half of ours basically is in the Pacific, all of theirs basically is there, could be a 10-to-1 ratio. Overwhelming in terms of both the, you know, actual firepower, but also just the sheer number of platforms that could be used to neutralize, shall we say, our naval forces and capabilities in the theater. Have I got that number about right? Or is that in the prospect?
My estimate has been is that we're probably on any given day in the South China Sea, there's probably 10-to-1 advantage of the PLA Navy over the U.S. Navy. Now, that could change at different times when a carrier strike group transits through, but on a kind of a continuing permanent basis with these three major naval bases down in the Spratlys at Mischief Reef, Fiery Cross, and Subi Reef that have major naval air stations there as well, 10,000-foot runways at these three places, we know that there's a lot of ships down there. That's why they're able to harass the Filipinos at Second Thomas Shoal on a routine basis now. Why they're able to challenge every U.S. Navy warship and foreign warship that even enters the South China Sea. And it's much the same in the East China Sea. So the balance of power, if you go back in 2005, the United States had an advantage of about 75 warships and submarines over the United States Navy in 2005. As of 2022, that advantage has shifted to the PLA Navy, that they have 57 more warships than we do. And as you mentioned, we're split 50-50. And these are comparable, similar types of warships. So when people say they're not comparable, that's not true. The only thing that we lead still on is numbers of aircraft. But in the last decade, China has put three aircraft carriers in the water, and we've only put one.
And Jim, just on this point of the number of ships, are you counting in that 10 to 1 all these other platforms, these marine militias and coast guards and other elements?
The LA Navy.
So if there is actually the capability on some of those other ships to have offensive weapon systems brought to bear, that just exacerbates even further the danger that you've pointed out in this dangerous era of concern. Jim Fennell, we have to take another break. We'll be right back with more. I'm very pleased to say we've got a third segment to come and much more to discuss about what we need to be doing about this decade of concern and whether we're going to have the leadership that is required to do what we must. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back. We're continuing our conversation with Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired, a member, I'm very proud to say, of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, and one of the thought leaders and influencers, well, both in uniform, but now that he's taken it off, for many of us who have been trying to track the military buildup of the Chinese Communist Party and the threat that it poses to our friends and allies in the region, for sure, but also unfortunately, for us as well. And Jim, to tie these two subjects together, we've been talking about leadership. We've been talking about the quality of it. We've been talking about the distractions that we've seen the U.S. military subjected to under this leadership. And I'm talking about civilian, yes, but also in uniform. And the question before the United States Senate, it seems to me, should be, I'm fond of the analogy of someone who has a drinking problem or abuses drugs, and you find it gets to such a point where an effort is made by their friends, their family members, their medical practitioners, and so on to have an intervention. It seems to me that what you've just laid out in terms of, well, the insufficiency of our military capabilities in important respects, not every, but enough, and the fact that they're likely to become worse as this Chinese buildup relentlessly continues, and our, subtraction of naval assets, whether they have to go into, repair or whether they're simply being retired prematurely because we want to put the money into something else. And the leadership that is making the decisions about whether you know, this is unacceptable. You talked about the revolt of the admirals being something that's desperately needed here. Whether we find ourselves now at a point where the Senate of the United States needs to build on what Tommy Tuberville has made possible here, which is to intervene and say, you know, we're not going to promote these people who think the most important thing is climate change or transgender rights or LGBTQ's agenda or, you know, jabs or CRT. This would seem to me to be such a moment. Your thoughts, sir?
I think, you know, before this kind of current era with the Biden administration, there was a, you'd have people that would pipe up and say, wow, we have more admirals than we have warships. That was heard in the last 5-10 years from different people. So this problem is something that has been building. And we have a bureaucracy in the Pentagon, at least, that's out of control. And we have so many layers of non-combat related actions and activities and funding that we're really unable to change the course that we're on. I think of Gulliver and the Lilliputians and the wires that are crossing them and keeping them from being able to move. And that's where we're at. And so we need something to break us out. And I believe that Senator Tuberville has actually provided us an opportunity to stop and look at ourselves. The problem is that it's been politicized and it's become this, you know, left or right, woke versus conservative mindset, as opposed to really stopping and saying, are we able to actually defend the nation? Are we able to actually deter the People's Republic of China from invading Taiwan? We didn't do it against Russia, against Ukraine. We did not deter them. They did it. They did it twice. They did it in 2014 and they did it in 2021. So here we are.
With Chinese permission, I think it's fair to say, at least in the second case.
Right. So we haven't done what we were supposed to do by commission, by our oath of office. It said, I swear to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. We all take that oath in the military. We all swore to that every time we got promoted. And so do civilians, by the way, in the Department of Defense. And we haven't done it. We didn't complete it. It's clear that we haven't. Russia invaded Ukraine. China is daily surrounding and threatening Taiwan. There's an aircraft carrier strike group from China that's east of Taiwan right now operating. Okay, that's the new normal that they've created in the last 25 years. We have Kim Jong-un of North Korea going to Russia to talk about how he can provide artillery to the Russians, which, oh, by the way, what Kim wants in return is nuclear warfare technology that he's probably going to get from Russia and China. We know that his already nuclear program that he has already has strong connections to the PRC, despite what people in the intelligence community told us over the last 25 years, that China was helping the United States on North Korea. All lies, all failures to the duty that they swore when they said they would defend this nation. So what we need is something to recognize that, as you said, if you're an alcoholic, you recognize you have alcoholism. Now what do you do? And we have still people that refuse to recognize that we have alcoholism, or as I like to say, because I had cancer, recognize you have a tumor in your gut. And you can't just leave it there. The cancer will kill you. So you have to either take chemotherapy or you have to have a knife to cut it out. And we don't want to do either one.
Or both. Jim, so much there to unpack. And I think you've made the point very, very eloquently indeed. Whether it's the fact that the Chinese are now operating east of Taiwan regularly, whether they've built these bastions, as you mentioned, in the South China Sea, which now is enabling them to dominate. They claim it's their sovereign, you know, waters and airspace now, but they could certainly control it, I think, if they choose to. Whether it's North Korea, you know, it seems to me all of these have one thing in common, and we can point to dozens of other issues which you follow every day. Their preparations for a shooting war. They are, you know, not simple peacetime adjustments in their operational tempo and the like. They are preparations for war. And I, again, I'm just mindful that it's against this backdrop that everything else has to be considered. Whether we, you know, are equipping our forces adequately, modernizing them, or even maintaining what we've got, whether we are training the personnel to operate them properly. We've had Colonel John Venable talking about, you know, the number of flying hours that pilots in the Air Force have, which he says is insufficient to enable them to operate those aircraft safely. That this, I mean, it's not just that they won't be able to perform the mission. And as you said, Jim, and it's the critical point, it seems to me, the mission is in the first instance to prevent a war, not just to fight it and win if it comes, but to make it, you know, something that does not occur in the first place, which we have a powerful interest in. And the question, just to come back, if I can, to Admiral Franchetti, because she's due for her confirmation hearing before the Senate Armed Services Committee. And if the committee's treatment of C.Q. Brown a month or so ago is any guide, she probably won't get a serious, or certainly a tough question put to her, maybe even about China, let alone about whether this Navy is up to the job of deterring it. It is, in your judgment, sir, she the right person for the CNO's role at a moment such as this?
Well, Frank, I just don't see, from my knowledge of knowing her and her career path, I don't think she's a disruptor. She is somebody that knows the system and has spent a lot of time in D.C. She's got some overseas time as well, but is not somebody that's going to stand and go toe-to-toe with the Secretary of the Navy and say, hey, this is not acceptable. And she was under the previous CNO, Admiral Gilday, is basically his deputy, and we didn't see any of that. Towards the end, Admiral Gilday started to speak out about China, but we never heard from her. And so I'm just worried that she's a person that's going to be passive when this is the very time that we need somebody that is going to be challenging where we're at. Because if we don't do it right now, it will be too late in 5 years or whatever her tenure would be, 4 years. If in the end of her tenure as CNO, if we do not disrupt the go along, the get along, the continuing trajectory that we're on, which is down in terms of numbers of ships that we're building, we're not going to be able to not even let alone deter, but we will not be able to win a war at sea. And I know that there's a lot of people that may disagree with me, and we have plans about distributed maritime operations, and we're talking about drones and unmanned systems. But the fact of the matter is, we're outgunned and outnumbered by the PLA Navy in the Western Pacific. And they're operating further and further to the east, closer to Hawaii, and they're going to put us at great risk. And we need somebody that's going to stand tall and say, this is unacceptable, and say, we got to be ready to fight. And I worry about that because she doesn't, for one, she's also in her career background, she's a surface warfare, and nothing against the surface warfare community, but she hasn't really had a lot of operational command tours. I mean, somebody like Admiral Papro was the J3 at, you know, CENTCOM, and he commanded the Combined Air Operations Center and did combat operations with the Air Force. And he flies Air Force planes as well as Navy planes. He was a Top Gun. I mean, he's somebody that exudes this kind of attitude of, we got to fight to win.
A warrior commander.
Yeah. And maybe that just impugns her. I don't mean to, but that's not what I've seen throughout her career. And it's not a matter of whether she's a woman or not. I served at sea with women that could fly and land F/A-18s on a pitching deck at night. So it's not about their gender. It's about their qualifications and their career track. As we talked before, if I took her career track and I laid it over a man, I'm not sure that that man would even make the third star, let alone a fourth star.
Let alone become the CNO, the Chief of Naval Operations. Jim Fennell, we have to leave it at that. Thank you again for your clarity on all these points, as well as your leadership, my friend. God bless you, and keep up the great work you do at the Geneva Center for Security Policy. We'll be right back with more right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Speaker Kevin McCarthy's announcement yesterday that the House will launch a formal impeachment inquiry of Joe Biden surely starts the countdown to the president's early departure from office. Of course, the Senate seems unlikely to convict when, not if, the House impeaches this chief executive for bribery, other high crimes and misdemeanors, and deservedly for treason. Rather, he'll have to go because even his own partisans will conclude that his position is untenable and they stand to suffer politically if he remains in office. No patriotic American can relish the prospect that, at least for a time, Kamala Harris might, like her running mate, become president in name only. But she, too, will have to go, lest she precipitate a GOP electoral landslide too big to steal. Fraught history is being made. And we must pray the Republic survives it. This is Frank Affney. We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we are joined by one of the most distinguished diplomats I know. His name is Yoram Ettinger. He served with the rank of ambassador in the Embassy of Israel, his native country, in Washington, D.C., where he was a specialist in relations with the Congress, but I think more generally an extraordinary, well, practitioner of the tradecraft of diplomacy with Americans. Activity that he continues with the Ettinger Report these days and with his appearances here and elsewhere. We're always delighted to have him with us. Mr. Ambassador, welcome back to Securing America.
Thank you. It's my privilege.
I'm anxious to get your take as a, well, close observer of both things here and certainly in the region in which you live, of the administration of Joe Biden's latest deal with the Islamic Republic of Iran, which seems to have given them about $6 billion in exchange for five Americans taken hostage by the regime in Iran. Your take on what we know about this deal so far and what you think might come of it?
Well, I think it's sad evidence that policymakers, some of the research institutions in Washington haven't really absorbed the primary lessons of September 11, which we just commemorated. And I think a prime message of September 11 is that terrorists bite the hand that feeds them. Going back to the 1980s, it was the U.S. which made the difference in the battle of the Mujahideen those days in Afghanistan against Soviet occupation. And once the Soviets ran away, were expelled from Afghanistan, complement of American military and financial and training assistance, the first thing that the Mujahideen turned to was to advance their well-entrenched fanatic religious vision, namely to bring the West and especially the great American Satan to submission, irrespective of the fact that it was the U.S. that enabled them to expel the Soviets from Afghanistan. By the way, the same thing took place years ago when the U.S. recognized the PLO, which did not prevent the PLO to collaborate with other Islamic terrorists and blowing up through car bombs the Marine headquarters and the U.S. embassy in Beirut. And in the case of Iran, we have seen exactly the same thing. It was the U.S. and American president, then Jimmy Carter, his national security advisor, Brzezinski, who provided the most critical tailwind to the Ayatollahs to take over stronghold in Tehran in Iran. And it didn't take long for those Ayatollahs, rather than express gratitude to the U.S. for its help, once again, they did bite the hand that fed them. They took over the American embassy, and they held some 50 Americans hostage for 444 days and have emerged since then as the number one anti-American terror entity. And then you can go back to 2015. U.S. was responsible for the nuclear accord with Iran, the JCPOA, which netted the Ayatollahs some $150 billion, which, as expected, were dedicated to bolster the anti-American terror machine of the Ayatollahs. And here we have again the same mistake being repeated at the expense of dire American interests.
Yeah, and you know what you've described very eloquently, of course, is just one example of Einstein's famous description of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. The jihadis do jihad. That's what they're all about. And they believe that Allah has directed them to do it, enabling them with aid or with providing them countries to run or, providing billions and billions and billions of dollars, to say nothing of $83 billion worth of arms in Afghanistan, just does not end well. And the truth of the matter is, and I, as a man who has worked the diplomatic portfolio extensively and for decades, I just would ask you, sir, is there any possible outcome if you reward jihadis specifically for taking hostages of Americans, in this case, that you'll get more hostage taking in the future?
Well, it's obvious when you commit gestures towards rogue elements, when you retreat in face of rogue threat and rogue terrorism, you only whet the appetite of the rogue elements, and there is an obvious follow-up: more terrorism, more anti-American sentiments. There is the illusion, probably overall Western culture illusion, that everybody thinks like Westerners do. Namely, everybody wants to live peacefully together, peaceful coexistence, democratic human rights environments. The problem is that this is a Western, not Middle Eastern, not Ayatollah's type of reality. And as far as they're concerned, the recent American policy, by the way, in Afghanistan and currently in the Persian Gulf, is a reflection of American weakness. There is an illusion among some Americans, that if you disengage from terrorists, you free yourself of terrorists. You don't disengage. You
Doesn't
run away, and they're going to chase you all the way to New York.
Mr. Ambassador, it translates into, as they like to say in Tehran, more death to Americans, but also more death to Israelis, I fear. And this is intolerable, frankly. We have to take a short break. We'll be right back with more with Ambassador Yoram Edinger right after this. Stay tuned. We're back. We're continuing our conversation with the distinguished former ambassador to the United States with the Congressional Portfolio for the Government of Israel. His name is Yoram Edinger, a great friend and very valued contributor to this program. Mr. Ambassador, we were talking about this mantra that the Iranian regime has expressed since it came to power with, as you said, our help, namely death to America, but also death to Israel. And I'm concerned that in the midst of an environment in which it's clear that the Iranians can have a nuclear weapon at any moment, if they haven't actually already gotten one, and that death to Israel is therefore that much more tempting an option for them, that there is this ongoing ferment within your country that could only, I think, encourage them to believe that this may be a moment to strike. Tell us a little bit about what the lay of the land is in Israel with the Palestinians on the one hand, but also within Israel's own political, you know, community that seems set on self-destruction in certain quarters.
Well, we reside in a very volcanic, intolerant, violent neighborhood, and being faced by enemies such as the Ayatollahs of Iran, their proxies in Lebanon and Syria, Hezbollah or Hamas in Gaza, or generic, so to speak, Palestinian terrorists, is not something new. In fact, myself, while I'm aware of the actual cost and the potential cost, I'm also aware of the many benefits such an environment has forced us, to excel in many respects. Just like climatically, having less and less natural rain, we have been forced to develop groundbreaking, innovative irrigation technologies, whether it's desalination or sewage recycling or transforming air into water. We have done that, by the way, for the benefit not only of Israel, but of humanity at large, because of the regional constraints. And likewise, militarily, we are surrounded by threats. The Iranians, for instance, are among the top ballistic engineers, technologies in the world. And that has forced us to develop more and more innovative defense technologies, offensive technologies. We are aware that among our neighbors, there is also American weaponry and West European and Russian and Chinese. And that has made our defense industry, aerospace industry, much more advanced than most countries, probably second only to the USA. And that, by the way, has benefited the U.S. very much. The Ayatollahs of Iran consider us to be the little Satan. The U.S. is the great Satan. But as far as they're concerned, there's no right for so-called infidel sovereignty in the so-called abode of Islam. But in addition to that, they are aware that we are the most effective American outpost in this very critical region. And they know that if they hit us, they hit the U.S. as well.
Well, I hope so. The question I just wanted quickly to ask you to address is, we've been hearing a lot about Israeli reservists saying they're not going to turn up for military service because of their concerns about the government of Israel, you know, crushing democracy by reforming the Supreme Court there. Just in a minute, could you tell us whether that is a further inducement, perhaps, to Israel's enemies to think this is a moment that they can act aggressively against you?
Well, there's no doubt that the weaker we may be seemed, the more emboldened our enemies. But I just want friends of Israel overseas to relax. Even among the most ardent protesters against government policies, whenever asked, they say, Should there be confrontation, you can count on us, the protesters, to be first to report to our position, Air Force Special Operations, armored units, etc. And this has been the story of Israel from 1948.
Well, this is absolutely critical, I think, for everyone to understand, and praise God for that. Let me ask in closing, Mr. Ambassador, I think something that is animating the Biden administration's, well, hostility, I don't think that's an exaggeration, towards Israel, towards the government of Israel, at the very least, under Benjamin Netanyahu, and its attitude towards the Iranians and, you know, the Chinese, for that matter, and others that are, well, adversaries, yes, but enemies, I think, actually, more accurately, is, in the words of my friend and colleague, Paul Teller, I think you know him well, he served for many years on Capitol Hill, he's just written a piece for the Jewish News Syndicate, which points out the extent to which anti-Semitism is now rife within the Democratic Party. Just a quote from this piece, he said, quote, "Not all Democrats are anti-Semites, but anti-Semites, especially high visibility anti-Semites," like parenthetically members of the House Democratic Caucus, "are tolerated in only one major party in America, the Democratic Party." I've got 30 seconds. Your thoughts on that phenomenon?
Well, it seems to me that there is direct correlation between distancing oneself from the legacy of America's founding fathers on the one hand and attitude towards Israel on the other hand. The founding fathers did regard the Old Testament as one of their pillar of fire, source of inspiration. And once you remove yourself from the legacy of the founding fathers, you also remove yourself from the Jewish state.
Yeah, and I think it bodes ill for our country as well as, of course, for yours. Mr. Ambassador, thank you for your visit. As always, your insights are incredibly valued. We look forward to talking with you again soon and to talking to the rest of you again next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.